Evening, comrades and friends. So it's afternoon where I'm speaking from. Thank you for inviting me to give a talk. My name is Darren O'Neill. I'm a formerly member of the SPGB and now live in America. So technically I'm a member of the World Socialist Party in the United States. And tonight's talk, if I can just find the title, is Poverty's No Joke, Eva Torf Judd's and Working Class Memory. Don't worry if you don't really understand that title, because I don't either, to be honest. I was kind of caught on the spot to come up with a title for the Social Standard deadline, and I knew I wanted to speak on Eva Torf Judd's, and I guess I was just feeling particularly pretentious that day, and unfortunately I came up with this daft title. But I hope that won't detract from the talk itself. Dougie's the chair. Dougie, I hope you're going to be very active, because I'll either dry up after 5 minutes or I'll ramble on for an hour. So please intervene if I talk too much. Okay. Start this talk by saying, strange way to start it, but I like the SPGB. You know, been a member, joined the party first in 1988. I have a great deal of affection for the SPGB. And because of that, I like to read about it, study about it, and find stuff out about it. You know, then I think, you know, we kind of self-deprecate too much. We're down on ourselves too much for an old party. We've not achieved our objects, etc. And as a consequence, we have a tendency not to kind of, for want of a better expression, celebrate ourselves. So, as I say, down the years, I've developed this interest in reading about the party. Trying to find out stuff about the party is not already out there. And sometimes kind of stumbling across like little kind of strange bits of information about the party, which is not kind of either public knowledge or hasn't appeared in the Standard, etc. Some of it's more frivolous than other things. And, you know, from the top of my head, things that I've kind of down the years where I've kind of stumbled across ideas is, for example, Keith Scholey, an ex-member of the party, and myself, discovered this writer called Dan Bellaney, who, I think it was us who actually discovered this. We discovered he was actually a member of the SPGB in Hull Branch in the early 1930s. And he'd been written about as one of the finest novelists of the Second World War. He actually died during the Second World War. And it was actually us that actually discovered that he was an SPGBer. Other kind of like little facts that we've kind of dug out is, actually, I'll skip that. If people want to ask me about sort of frivolous facts about SPGB after the meeting. If I remember what was the saying, the only other time I've spoken at one of these meetings was about 2 or 3 years ago, and I spoke about the digitization of the Socialist Standard, a project that myself and others have undertaken because we were interested in, you know, making sure the party's history was available on the net. And this is connected to this meeting tonight. And one of the articles, or obituary rather, that I put on the blog, Socialist Standard Past and Present blog, was for a party member called Eva Torf Judd, who was a member of the party from 1935 to 1941, when sadly she died in an aerial bombing in Southampton. And the obituary is available from the September 1941 Socialist Standard. And in the obituary, it's mentioned, and it was also mentioned in Baltrop's book, The Monument, Story of the SPGB, that she'd worked on a manuscript, an autobiography, that she'd completed but had not been published just before, you know, our sad death. And I remember posting this. I posted this actually originally back in 2014. But in April 2021, I suddenly got a comment on this post 7 years later. And it turned out it was from a guy called Joe Fenton, who lives in Los Angeles. And he was actually, he's actually the grandson of Eva Torf Judds. And he, because I'd mentioned in a comment, you know, I'd love to have seen it. One of those what ifs, you know, we'll never get to see this autobiography. And Joel contacted me in April 2021 and he said, you know, wow, I was looking up my grandmother and I saw you mentioned her and I have a copy of the manuscript, photocopied, scanned in. Would you like a copy? And obviously I said yes. And he provided me with a link and I downloaded it to, you know, and there it was, you know, this manuscript from, I believe it's 1939. I sent a copy of the front page to Paddy, who could possibly post it up if he could, just, you know, proof of what I'm saying. I don't have the knowledge to post pictures on Zoom. And there you go. Stones for Bread, or Poverty's No Joke, that explains part of the title of the meeting, by Eva Torf Judd, dedicated to Judith, my mother. That would have been Joel's mother. Judith, my mother, and Judith, my daughter, Judith's, Joel's mother. And as you can see, she was living in Southampton at the time when she wrote the manuscript. And I guess I just wanted to maybe give over this meeting to maybe like talking about this manuscript, this unpublished autobiography, because it has a wonderful read. She was actually a very fine writer, and it's sad that it never found a publisher. And it's just maybe just, as I say, because of my interest in the party, and I think we don't celebrate it, for want of a better term enough, I think, when we have the opportunity to talk about our history or one of our comrades, fallen comrades, then we should take that opportunity. So I just want to maybe just give some like brief outline about the manuscript. I could go into too much detail, which I won't. I can in the questions and answers. Just giving some background on Eva herself, because it is a fascinating story, absolutely fascinating story, and it's, you know, gives you a kind of insight into, like, you know, to crowbar the title of the meeting in working class memory. So Eva herself was born in the East End of London. Her family were Lithuanian Jews. She doesn't actually mention the date of her birth, but I'm kind of guessing it would have been like maybe the turn of the century. Obviously, the pogroms in the Russian Empire meant that you, from the 1880s onwards, you had a whole wave of migration of Jewish people to the West, to America, to Britain, escaping, you know, persecution. And a lot of them settled in the East End of London, the East End of Glasgow, the East End of Liverpool. And Eva's family happened to settle in the East End of London, Bethnal Green. She mentions that her family from in the East End of London were kind of caught between two communities. They were actually kind of ostracized from both the Jewish community, this is her as a young girl, and the Christian community, because her parents, in dire poverty, her father basically looking for charity, had gone to a Christian charity and to basically qualify for this charity. And this was a guy who was a Talmudic scholar, actually was baptized and allowed himself to become a Christian just so he could actually have enough food to feed, you know, and his family and himself. And, you know, Eva Torf Judd, in the course of her manuscript, basically explains how this had an impact on her family and how she felt a certain alienation from her surroundings as a consequence. You know, she was to the Jewish community. She wasn't considered Jewish. Her family to the Christian community weren't considered Christian. And as I say, she was born into extreme poverty. She suffered from rickets as a child, which she mentions many times in her manuscript. And at a very young age, her family decided to try and escape this poverty by immigrating to America. And she mentions our family moving to, this is the first of many moves, Our family first moves to New York when she's a young girl, preteen, and they live in a tenement in Harlem. This would have been maybe 1908, 1909. And she mentions that she was a she was a book lover as a child. She did love of books. And as a young girl, maybe because of this experience of being so alienated from a community, she became a Zionist as a young woman, as a young girl rather. Her family became Zionist to the point where she would even refuse to speak English to her family. This was obviously pre the creation of Israel. They were obviously looking for a better life in America. But unfortunately, they went from the poverty of East End of London to the poverty of New York. And she joined the workforce when she was 12 or 13, working in a dingy factory, like a clothes factory in New York. And this is the period of the Triangle Waste fire that some people will know about, an industrial fire that killed over 100 girls, I believe. I think it was 1913. And this was the working environment that she entered into. At the same time, she shared her Zionism and started to embrace radical ideas, her and her sisters. And at the time in New York, there was obviously the street speakers, all these active groups. And as a consequence, she embraced, what she considered radical ideas under the grind of this poverty. And, I should be quoting from the manuscript, but I don't want to drag out the meeting too long. Her family, just all through the course of this book, this manuscript rather, this grind in poverty resulted in first her family and then herself as an adult, basically trying to go somewhere better. The idea that something was better around the corner. So they had the grinding poverty of New York, and that led them to go into Chicago because they thought Chicago must be better, only to be met with more poverty. But there she met anarchists and sort of was discussing anarchist ideas. From there, she found work in Chicago as a garment worker, joined the garment workers union and caused a strike in her first week working there because it was a closed shop, so she joined the union as soon as she was told to. But as she explains in the manuscript, she was so bad a worker that her boss tried to fire her straight away, and the union called out a strike on her behalf. And I guess it was her first example of kind of solidarity and support amongst working class and give her some ideas. Again, Chicago didn't turn out too well for her. I'm being a bit too chronological here, I apologize. But I just want to give some background to her. From Chicago, they actually went back to New York. Because again, this would have been a time of 1913, 1914. Basically, it seems like she was bouncing around various cities trying to find the American dream, her family, and just could never find it. And then in both New York and Chicago, she got involved in anti-conscription work because it was the time of war preparation in America. America obviously didn't join the war in 1914, but by 1915, 1916, America was getting ready to take sides. And war fever was building up. There was a lot of anti-Germanism, Germanic feeling. And she joined the Anti-Conscription League, going to meetings, selling pamphlets. And there's some quite kind of graphic examples of the jingoistic violence meted out against people who were actually arguing against America entering the war. At this period, she recounts one example of a report of two men who had been speaking out against the war being accosted by a mob and having to kneel down and to kiss the American flag by a mob. And then they were actually sexually assaulted by the mob on top of that. So it's, you know, this is obviously a very, very tumultuous time, and she was in the thick of it. And then, believe it or not, she went, from Chicago, she actually went to Los Angeles, and she was in Los Angeles at the time of the Russian Revolution. And obviously being from a Jewish Eastern European background, she couldn't help but being caught up in the kind of expectation and hope of the Russian Revolution. She's quite, you know, unapologetic about that, quite honest about that in her text. And during the course of the, you know, it's very funny, sort of quite funny passages in the book about how she's so expectant about the revolution. But from there, she's migrating again, looking for work. This is a permanent theme of the book, and ends up in Seattle in Northwest America. And it's there she meets her husband, George Judd, who's actually an Englishman who'd basically left England when he was 20 and was worked on the ships and was a member of the Socialist Labour Party, the Leninist Socialist Labour Party, and was a member of the Workers' International Industrial Union, which was the Leninists' version of the IWW. And it's there that she met George and married George. And, you know, it was a happy marriage by all accounts, but it was one ground down by poverty. And from Seattle, they had to go to both San Francisco and Oakland in California in search of work, where their daughter, Judith, was born. From Oakland, they went back to Los Angeles and then back to San Francisco. And whilst in San Francisco, she'd always been more of a backroom activist. She'd been sort of person who would sell newspapers or attend meetings, but she never felt confident enough to be a speaker. But it was in San Francisco that she became a union official, was involved in the Central Labor College in San Francisco. And by her own accounts, she, you know, became a speaker, public speaker, and she goes into detail about how it took a while for her to be this public speaker, and then she had to kind of stumble through it a wee bit. In San Francisco, again, they met with poverty, and basically this is round about the period that the Great Depression of 1929 starts, and they're both active social, they're both active socialists, but they decide, but at the same time, they're having to somehow survive to the best of their ability. And they decide to try and go to Canada, because Canada's promising a new start for people, the victims of depression. So they end up in Vancouver Island. Really. Unfortunately, it doesn't pan out. It's one of these bill of goods which is sold to people, which turns out to be a bit of a con. And in desperation, they just have to go back to San Francisco. And George decides, you know, in the midst of a depression, he decides to become a cobbler and sets up a shoe service, which fails. Poverty being such a theme of this work. And then Eva decides that it's maybe time to go back to New York. She has family in New York. She has friends in New York. And there's a fascinating chapter where it wasn't George and Eva that hitchhiked across New York. He had to stay with Judith, the daughter, back in San Francisco. But she hitchhiked across America with another woman called Molly. And there's all the story, you know, there's encountering the racism, the casual racism in Texas, the kindness along the way of the hitchhiking, but also the experiences of charities, the bad side of charities, because they would, you know, they would find themselves in a town and they approach like the local YWCA for a bed for the night. And the way they were kind of treated as the undeserving poor is a real eye-opener. You know, the social workers of the day were, you know, just basically treating the, you know, working people as nothing more than pieces of trash. They finally reached New York, and there's the first mention of the party in New York, because she actually, some of the friends that she was staying with were SPGBers, formerly SPGBers. And though it's not mentioned in the text, I think she might be referring to an SPGBer called Sid Felferin, who was a member of Hackney Branch back in the 1920s, emigrated to New York, and then was an active member of the WSPUS for the rest of his life. I can't confirm that. In New York, they're meeting poverty again, you know, in the midst of the Depression. It was like 1929, 1930. But George and Judith joins them in New York. And then it transpires, because they're having to apply for charity relief, it transpires that because they'd briefly left America to go to Canada and then came back, it was basically the authorities are trying to deal with mass unemployment. They use it as an excuse to deport George, Eva, and Judith, even though Judith was American, to England, because they'd illegally re-entered America without a proper permit when they came back from Canada. So there's a story of them, and there was hundreds of people in the same position. I would say the same boat, because they eventually did leave on a boat from Ellis Island to go back to Britain. And she arrives back in Britain around about 1933, 1934. And she basically ends up back in the East End of London. This time she ends up in Stepney, I believe. And again, it's a series of chapters explaining their experience of this almost Kafkaesque bureaucracy of where they were applying for charity relief, for support, because they were in dire straits, and how the authorities basically took it upon themselves to just refuse them. So there's all these stories of them living in basements with bugs in the West End of London, where if they complained about bugs, the landlady would bring in some kerosene to burn the bugs. But at the same time, because they're both politically active, Eva mentions going to May Day in Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner, in 1934 and 1935, and she expresses her disappointment at the May event, because she just kind of recognised the grinding poverty in the faces of the marchers. And, you know, she basically is acknowledging, you know, the capitalist class have nothing to be scared of. You know, if this is the working class, then unfortunately, you know, we're going to continue the system that we have. Goes into detail of living in the southeast end of London, near Fleming Castle, and then back to the east end of London. And she mentioned the SPGB again. Outdoor speaking in Cambridge Road, which I believe is Bethnal Green. And she obviously knew about the SPGB and was sympathetic to the SPGB, but she couldn't get her head around what she described as a doctrinarian approach. And basically she, for a period of time, at this time, believed, you know, something had to be done now, you know, possibly because of her own personal circumstances. But, you know, she had some kind of sympathy towards the Labour Party, thinking maybe, okay, maybe the Labour Party's not perfect, but maybe it can do something. And then, but as revealed as the manuscript goes on, her experience of the Labour Party, her experience of a Labour council in West Ham when she and her family were applying for public assistance committee relief, showed that the reality was that the Labour Party, you know, despite all its phraseology and its supposed commitment to social justice, could just be as stringent and as venomous against, you know, poor people seeking relief. And this was a bit of a wake-up call, and there's some excellent passages which I can dig out and read if anybody's interested later on, where she doesn't just stick the boot into the Labour Party, but also sticking the boot into the co-op movement. Because she said, well, this was nothing like Robert Owen envisaged when, you know, the cooperative movement was an idea in the 1840s. It's become something completely different. And she's especially funny talking about Toynbee Hall in the East End of London. If people don't know what Toynbee Hall is, it's like a, probably can't explain it well, maybe somebody else can. It was like it was when the middle class, the liberal middle class, radical middle class in the Victorian period in the early 2000s discovered the poor and decided they wanted to elevate them and help them. So they would go into these poor districts, especially in London, and set up these permanent communities. That's how Clement Attlee ended up in the East End of London. That was his experience. He became radicalised via Toynbee Hall, you know, eventually became Labour Prime Minister, but he initially started out as this public school lawyer trying to, you know, serve the poor for a couple of years in the East End of London. And she's very good. She's brilliantly funny and basically sneering unfair to her, but basically just calling them out for what they are, which was, you know, people who always wanted the poor to be there because they always wanted to serve them, so to speak. And they wanted, you know, they basically wanted to be seen to be doing something. And, you know, that's politics today, I would argue, for a lot of the left. She also mentions hot picking in Kent. There's a really good chapter on hot picking in Kent. Where she, you know, her and her family go down, basically as the working holiday that the working class of the East End of London would do every summer because they couldn't afford holidays. So they go down to pick the hops in Kent and just basically live there for like 3 or 4 weeks. And she, you know, there's more details about her scorn for the Labour Party. And then she, because of George's family connections to Southampton, it turned out that the public assistance boards in the East End of London were like, well, you're alien. They'd actually say this, and you're aliens. You may be technically English, but you've just turned up in our district and you're costing us money on the rates. So they used the excuse that George's family connection was in Southampton to basically say, yeah, okay, you're Southampton's problem. And basically, you know, this idea of shifting the poor from one area to another, nothing new. There's nothing new here. And they ended up in Southampton in the 1936, 1937. In Southampton, they're active politically to a certain extent, but Eva's always constantly drawn back to London and mentions how she kind of reevaluated her politics and eventually came to agree with the SPGB. Joining the SPGB in, I believe it was July 1935, and George himself joined the SPGB in August 1935. And on the membership forms, it mentions that people have ever seen the database that Keith Scully put together. It sometimes mentions, you know, previous organisations were members of. Eva had been a member of the Proletarian Party in America, which unfortunately, sadly, is not mentioned in the manuscript. That was an interesting political organization that came out of Detroit during the time of the Russian Revolution. In some ways, they were actually inspired by the SPGB, but they had this, I mean, at the same time, they were separate. You know, they like the SPGB's anti-reformism, our impossibilism, but at the same time, they had this kind of soft approach to the Russian Revolution in the same way that the SLP did. So she'd been a member of the Proletarian Party, and George had been a member of the Socialist Labour Party, and they'd both been members of the Labour Party of the USA. Now, the problem with that is I'm not sure which Labour Party they're referring to, because there's been quite a few in America down the years. My guess from like looking on Wikipedia is that there was a Deleonist Labour Party, a Deleonist split by a man called Joseph Brandon in New York. And they basically at some point became the Labour Party in 1932. And they were members of the Labour Party in America. I'm presuming because of George's background, that's the Labour Party they were members of. And then briefly in Britain, Eva had been a member of the Labour Party, soon regretted it. And they were both involved with the National Unemployed Workers Movement, which was a CPU-led single-issue campaign group, which the party had problems with because of the CP connections. So that was their political background prior to joining the SPGB. And then basically the manuscript kind of finishes, you know, quite downbeat. You know, obviously a lifetime of poverty, and you know, there's, you know, they've obviously committed themselves to the politics, but you know, sadly, sorry, but you know, it just finishes in a point where she explains the title of her book, Stones for Bread. It's a biblical quotation from Luke, I believe. So okay, I've probably done more of a chronology than anything, so I apologize if, you know, please ask me more questions and I maybe expand upon it. So why am I talking about this book now? Why is only a few people listening maybe heard of it? Because I remember mentioning it on Facebook at the time. Well, sadly, Joel was good enough to obviously allow me to read the manuscript, providing me with the manuscript. But his sister, when she heard about this, she was mortified. She really hated the idea that this manuscript had gone out of the hands of the family. And when I was initially corresponding with Joel back in April and May, a couple of years ago, I, you know, said, you know, can I share it? You know, can I possibly approach people about the potential of it being maybe published? I think there's maybe some people who'd be interested in this. And he initially was like, yeah, Jesus Christ, yeah, why not? You know, like, you're the first person in the 80 years to actually mention this manuscript. Why not? But his sisters kind of put the kibosh on that. And she claimed that, she said, I claim that's unfair to her. But apparently there's a family member who's a historian. And apparently 3 or 4 years down the line, when this family member is an historian is going to retire, he's going to concentrate on it. Which just seems strange to me as an explanation. Why would a historian have this kind of wonderful manuscript in front of them and then decide to defer it for 5 years? So there's a certain skepticism about that, but that's fair enough. From speaking to Joel, he obviously, you know, this is grandparents he'd never actually met. So this is his only knowledge of them. And the two pictures of Eva and George that I sent Paddy, he'd only come across these pictures in the last year. And he obviously just didn't see what I could see, which was a finely written document of working class, you know, working class autobiography, you know. And it's so he was not as enthusiastic as I was, but I generally think because it's so well written that it could possibly eventually be published and reach an audience. You know, it's as I say, I've got excerpts from the book which I could hunt down to recount, but I didn't want to drag the meeting out too long. I'm not even sure what time it is right now. Let me just check. Wow, I've been speaking too long. I apologize for speaking too long. I'll just leave it there for now. I'm sure there's other things I can think of, but
I'm sorry.